Hello and welcome to this Blackwell Online podcast. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Professor of History at York University, David Wootton. David has written a major new biography of Galileo, which, as you'll hear, seeks to challenge some of the received wisdom about the scientist and the man, not least his relationship with the Catholic Church, as David explained to me.
My starting point in the book is the following recognition that the very next being Dr. Galileo was set 450 years ago by his disciple Giuliani, who wrote Galileo's first biography, who collected his papers, who sorted through his papers, who probably destroyed many of his papers. And that way of interpreting Galileo was deliberately constructed so that we would see Galileo as a past conflict and as a great scientist, but a scientist from other times of philosophy. And I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of Galileo, and I think the document that Viviani left behind allows us to see that it's a fundamental misunderstanding of Galileo.
And the related story writes in the first page of the book about how many of Galileo's papers were actually rescued by a miracle, by a stroke of good fortune.
So when Viviani died, his collections were inherited by his nephews, and then his nephew, and then he died, and they were inherited by his great nephews. And his great nephews had no interest at all in Galileo. So they simply threw papers into a bin, a grain bin, which they put in the basement of their house, and obviously after a while it was in the well, and they wanted to get rid of it. So they started selling off this waste paper to be used for wrapping meat, just in the way some of them might use newspapers for wrapping fish and chips. And a Lucrese scholar one day went and bought some mortadella, some salami, and took it out wrapping it in the country and opened up the wrapping and realized that the stuff that he bought was wrapped in a letter from Galileo. So he went back to the book and took it from Galileo, and he sent him to Viviani's great nephews, and they took him down to the basement and showed this enormous tub full of all of Galileo's surviving papers. He didn't know how many things sold off the wrapping paper. Was the great hub of stuff that's still there. And when he called Nelly acquired this tub of paper, and those papers were almost nothing, and set out to write the first major biography of Galileo. And then the papers he acquired went into the five-town archive. And so everything we know about Galileo essentially comes out of that tub of worth paper. And if the nephews had managed to find a detail to write that meat, we would know nothing about Galileo, almost. Except for the printed text that survived from his own publication.
And you're going too far to see something symbolic in that neglect of Galileo, because there seems to be a pattern that he has been perhaps not accorded his due in the way that other figures of the Renaissance have been. You made the point that there are not a lot of books on the English, a lot of scholars who write on the Italian. So why do you think that is, that he's been comparatively passed over?
That's a very good question. Galileo is nobody's hero. And he's nobody's hero because he wasn't brave enough to go to the step to die on this. Because before him, Giordano Bruno had been prepared to be burnt alive rather than with cancer patients. Now, Bruno was an extraordinarily brave man. Galileo was something of a coward, but still a coward when he got himself into trouble. But certainly something of a coward. He also wasn't bold enough to flee from Italy and go to Holland. Somewhere where he could probably safely and distinct too. So Galileo is a man who compromises. He's an anti-hero, which is why the ultimate love is so proud of Galileo. And consequently, no one's adopted him. It's an attempt by a family factor of thought to adopt him, because he's pretty is a great man. But there's been this wrestling match about whether he should be seen as a spectacular Italian hero or as in recent literature, a textbook hero. And even though in the Italian culture, it's never been quite clear what it's expecting. So Galileo is nobody's hero, and this was true when Mary's great nephews were thrown away his documentary. That was somebody who'd been condemned for heresy, who was someone whose reputation was uncertain. At that point, it was very much legal to the Italian Catholic country to teach the Protestantism. And so there was no sense in that this was somebody whose papers were valuable and needed to be preserved. So the only one had that sense because he was going to be a faithful disciple, but he'd been quite unable to communicate that sense to the rest of the time, and let alone just York.
Let's talk about that then, and perhaps you can tell me something about the milieu into which he was born.
Galileo is very much the son of his parents. This is for all of us. Now, in the first of all, I think you can see it clearly. You can't always see it clearly. His father was a musician, and his father does research on the nature of music. He studies how to change notes by picking up experimental notes. His father is arguably one of the first experimental scientists. His father is deeply hostile to theory. He regards mathematical theory as something that is completely falsifying the empirical truth of what it is to be a musician. It's very frantic that as soon as Galileo becomes an adolescent, he discovers theoretical maths, and he says, this is what I want. I want him to become a doctor. Galileo refuses to become a doctor, but that is the most empirical of all the scientists. Galileo refuses to become a doctor, and insists on becoming the most theoretical of mathematicians. And Rene also resolves a family in love with theory, and he manages to rebellion against his father. At the same time, doing this experimental work, which is the first experimental work to really pay off in the country. So he always knew about the invention of his father. His mother, there's actually general agreement about this, so I'm going to say it very straightforwardly. His mother is a monster. We know he's a super monster. We know it from, for example, a letter sent to our late brother. He clearly goes on screaming at the children all the time. He steals from Galileo and Galileo as a grown up. He pays Galileo's servants to spy on him, and we have very good evidence that at one point when he was a young man, a sort of adolescent, he demands him to be positioned and gives evidence against him. And then to compare him, he does this, he turns on her and calls her a whore and things like that. I don't know what to expect him to do when he demands him to be positioned. He's brought up by this tyrannical monster mother, and that sets him in a line of life, I think, where he's desperately independent. He's very unbridled in all his dreams of authority. He's very quick to feel that he's been invaded and persecuted. And it's quite obvious for his mother, I think, that eventually turns up into a decisive ability to do his mind, which is the point of the day, where he's an exact repeat of Galileo's encounter, feeling the Pope is unreasonable with him, and the Pope feeling that Galileo is totally unreasonable in the plan. Now, Galileo didn't invent the telescope, but he was just looking sort of reverse engineer it, and he quickly managed to put together his own version of it. And here the telescope is absolutely critical to his story. But tell me a bit about his relationship with that, the kind of reverse engineer that's in the book. That's exactly right. That's exactly what he does. He's told about the telescope, letters come to Venice from France, to come with people say, well, you can look in the Holland and it's around. And he's given a description of it, and he worked out what it must be. It's very simple, really. I don't think it's particularly complicated. He worked out what it must be, and he brought it into the telescope very quickly with an astrophysicist. Then he has a remarkable section. It seems to us so obvious that it doesn't really grasp how much it can do. He thinks something like, well, how do we improve this? What are the limits of the perception of the telescope? How much more powerful can we make it to look at? The reason why this is remarkable is that nobody has been quite thinking of such a number. They were like, for example, Thomas Carey, very interesting. No one in England had one that started looking at the moon with one. Nobody had asked themselves, how powerful can we make it to look at? Within days of having a telescope, Galileo was trying to make more and more and more powerful telescopes. Within a few weeks, what he's got is something that's much more powerful than the telescope he's had before. He takes it to the world in Venice, the world's production, and he's trying to use it to get the telescope. And he says, you know, this is a really powerful thing that can be used for military purposes, naval purposes, to use to the enemy from the enemy's next array. And he's rewarded with much that massive increase in pay, and perhaps even more remarkably, I think he's the only person ever to be given a lifetime contract to the university, talking of rolling, filtering, and everything. So, Galileo turns the telescope into what we call work to become one of the highest-paid professors and into security. And he does it because he's got this idea of technological progress. He has that because he is committed to an action of intellectual progress in a way that most people think they don't.
Well, one of the central themes of the book is that Galileo became a convinced Copernican earlier than previous accounts of Galileo. What was it that persuaded you to that? I find it very difficult because the puzzle is not why do I think this, the puzzle is why did everyone else think anything different? In 1595, Galileo writes the letter to Kepler,
only public thing to come from Astronomer really is in Europe. And someone's given him a copy of that book. Galileo asked him, saying, how exciting to get rid of the planet, a fellow Copernican. I've been a Copernican for a number of years, and I've made remarkable discoveries based upon the Copernican theory. There's lots of things I can understand using Copernican. Looking at the seven, he said, I've been a Copernican for a number of years, he said, quite a number of years, so he's got no reason to be denied, he's got no motive to misrepresent himself. This is science and knowledge, in my view. This is important. Of course, he's not going around teaching Copernicanism in the university. What he wants power to do is teach from Plato, from Hesiod, he teach from Euclid, he teach from Aristotle, he teach from the case of astronomy, from the sphere of philosophy, which is what 18th century text. There's nothing about Copernicanism in the 13th century text. We're not supposed to teach it. Galileo doesn't teach it. He teaches what he is expected to teach if he wants to get his contacts to read every 3 years, like contacts for a year. So he's not teaching Copernicanism, he's not talking publicly about Copernicanism, but we have a whole massive information that goes to the only Copernican we've got that we know each other. We've got, for example, drawings we've got in the 2010 and 2016 years. We've got drawings we've got in 2004 that show that he's working with a Copernican model of things. So I can't think so quickly. What I tend to think of is when does it become a Copernican? And here there's a wonderful study, a long article that if you go to my website, you can find a link to it and download it. It's about 1,100 pages long, called Counting the Right Outcomes. It came out in 2001. And that article was the first to use newly printed evidence from the notebooks of Galileo's close friend, Paolo Sarpi, who was a theologian and a scientist. And Sarpi, in 1592, records a series of problems associated with the planet. And as soon as you read these, and you see that Galileo's also going outside of 1592, you know that these problems about the chromosomes that Sarpi was recording are the result of conversations with Galileo, whom he just met from their 1500 members that he met in 1492. So we actually have really solid evidence of what Galileo was saying to his friends in 1592. And from that, we can see that he's constructed as a plan for all the scientific objections to Copernicanism. So I'm actually confident, 1592, Galileo arrived in Venice, he's already a Copernican, and he's working in that country to find Copernicanism. And interestingly, with the only exercise that it's in 1592 that Galileo begins working with his book, which is published until 40 years later, and Galileo, like I said, has been working on this book for 35 years or whatever, and takes it back into this period. Standard view is that Galileo became a Copernican only after he used the telescope, only after he made his great discovery to it. The misunderstanding that we know is that Copernicanism to be defended requires new astronomy. Copernicanism is already recognized, we really do astronomy. The Exodus did astronomy, also we could predict where the planets were going to be in the heavens at any time, and we could use this for calculations people wanted to make, particularly astrological context. Everyone else is Copernicanism, it's really good astronomy, but kind of Copernicanism is that it was physically impossible. If the Earth is moving incredibly rapidly through the heavens, the Earth will fall over. Now, if we drop things, the Earth will fall backwards. The Earth has to transcend them in rapidly space. We need a physical theory which might explain how we might be moving it literally thousands of miles an hour and have no awareness of it. We know that Galileo developed this theory, four arguments, not to break down over 1632. In 1632, he carries out an experiment, which is the basis of that theory. The account of many members unaware of the movement of the, not experiencing, but undergoing the movement. And it's that new physical theory that led to the possibility of Galileo to say, we can now believe the planet as a mature planet of the world, and now I can start using it in the world. You alluded a little bit at the beginning to the attempts that have been made, repeated attempts been made, to recapitulate Galileo within the Catholic faith. And that's one of the other things that you challenge in this book. And you say that this matters because of the claims that have been made about the origins of the new science, sort of cultural, religious origins of the new science. Therefore, there's more to this, there's more at stake than simply whether one man believed in the Catholic faith or not. There's a lot at stake in this, I think. at the same time, I have to be careful not to overstate that sort of statement. First of all, let's talk about the origins of the movement. And there's a sense in which there's been a pushy-pullier argument going on where Darwinists now appear to be anti-Christian and will apply a Muslim movement. Look at the science in 2020, look at the science of Newton and Bohr, look at the founding Christian science. So the argument has been, well, this is just research, whether it's about science being put on the CCR, but that is about science that can be on hand in hand, and there's no clash between them. It becomes important then to ask, and are the 17th century scientists profoundly Christian? I'm sure Boyle was, and I asked him not Newton was, although you can see it very graphical. This is a general feature of 17th century science, so it's a feature of some scientists and others. I want to argue that Galileo is very clearly not a Christian religion. And I think that changes our understanding of the relationship between rationality and science. This is kind of a much bigger argument that I've been engaged in for, must be, you know, for 25, 30 years now, about whether there was any unbelief in 16th and early 17th century Europe. Very close to the unbelief, and I thought that one of the founders of the United States, Walter Thomas, had been published in 1942, so we all know 16th century exists. And I started my life reading when I was looking at Darcy, and discovering that in my textbooks, he got a sustained and systematic critique of all religious beliefs. And so when I came to Galileo, it was known that his best friend, in many ways, and his closest collaborator, was not a Christian. And then it turned out one of his other best friends, Kermelini, he was famous for educating the generation of atheists from that. And so one of the things I'm going to argue is that there is a profound, not only anti-clerical, but anti-Christian culture in Kentish Latinus, which becomes in many ways a step towards what I think of as Latinus. Many of the foundations of what we think of as modern thinking, and Galileo is part of that. It then becomes actually central to see that even though Galileo never explained that himself, I'm not a Christian, but of course he did that, he did not. If you were incredibly careful and formulated it in Latin, you could do it in Latin. Thomas Hardy might say, no, no, get close to whatever way you're saying. So, Galileo didn't speak out. And I think it's fundamental difference in a way between my biography of Galileo and everything that's come before that, is that I take seriously the pressure of his interesting. Not Galileo in public, in my life, because he's got to prove before publication, but also in what he does out in medical terms, because he's afraid that his first one is probably accepted. He goes through the length of the world, which has to be so far from the church of the answer, from the length of the system, really true. And even if it wasn't consent, because he's reported 6 times in the religion, and often on the basis of the conversations of his students. So Galileo can't even speak to me, or in the most serious circumstances, where he would need to learn with people he can really trust. And because I think there is this, as it were, a wall of deception between Galileo's internal convictions and his public expressions and even his conversations, that I think we have to engage in a very careful reason of the side of evidence in order to look for what's behind that wall. I don't think this is legitimate. I think it's essential because you can't understand people within what you might call a totalitarian culture, or a persecuted culture. You can't reason understand it unless you look for the impact of persecution.
David Wootton. Galileo, Watcher of the Skies, is available now in hard.